returned to school, Louis officially dumped me for Poppy. He confessed that they had been together since Thanksgiving break, but that he couldn't bear to break my heart before December 22nd. "I know how hard that first anniversary is," he said. "Gee, thanks," I said, doing everything I could not to cry. "That was very big of you." My final semester of college was brutal. I quit acting altogether and fell into a paralyzing depression, the loss of Louis and my brother hitting me at once. It was as if our obsessive relationship the year prior had simply delayed my true grieving process, and I was back to square one. My mother just waking me up from a sound sleep to tell me Daniel was dead. A professor who noticed my alarming loss of weight and slipping grades insisted that I see a university shrink. Therapy and drugs barely kept me afloat. The only bright spot came that spring when my acceptance letters rolled in from law schools, including one from Columbia. It wasn't Harvard or Yale, and law school was a far cry from neurosurgery, but it was still the Ivy League, and I knew my news made my parents proud. This, in turn, filled me with pride, which was better than being completely empty. A few months later, I got the hell out of Syracuse, moved to New York City, and threw myself into my first year of law school, doing my best to avoid the theater, plays, or any other cultural offerings. Maybe Louis was right, I thought, when I learned that he and Poppy were living in the Village and had joined the same theater company. Maybe I was a spineless sellout. Then again, maybe I was doing something noble and selfless, putting my parents first. I convinced myself that this was the case, and became determined to be their stable, successful child, the salve on their still open wounds. Of course, I think they hoped I would one day have a family, too, preferably in Atlanta. But if that didn't pan out for me, Josie would have that covered. At the time, she was dating a generically handsome boy named Will, who hailed from a good family, my mother's phrase, in Macon, had impeccable manners, and wore seersucker and white bucks on special occasions. The two quickly became serious, giddy in love, the kind of couple who laid claim to baby names before they're even engaged. She was doing her part to make my parents happy, and we forged a tacit agreement, an unspoken pact. I would accomplish and achieve from afar, and she would marry, become a mother, and provide the beautiful local grandchildren. Maybe it would make Dad stop drinking. Maybe it would bring our parents back together. At the very least, we would both help them move on in our so-called new normal, a term I despised. At my law school graduation, my parents presented me with my brother's briefcase, the same one they had given him on his 25th birthday. It was a moment that was more bitter than sweet, and I remember feeling intensely jealous of my sister's end of the bargain. I had a law degree and a briefcase. She had real happiness. Her life as a teacher seemed easy, punctuated by one happy hour and road trip after another. Most important, she had someone to love. Lest I become bitter, I reassured myself that her choices might actually free me in the long run. Maybe someday, I kept telling myself, as I passed the bar and went to practice litigation at a top Manhattan firm and billed 70 or 80 hours every week. Maybe someday, after Josie married Will and popped out a baby, I would follow my heart too. Maybe someday, I would be happy. But then, before I could cast off my legal bow lines, Josie fucked everything up in grand Josie style. She called me in the middle of the night, though I was still at work finishing a brief, bawling, telling me she had screwed up and that Will had dumped her. I asked her what happened, trying to sort out the facts so that I could offer her appropriate counsel. "It's a long story," she said, her line whenever something was her fault or she didn't want to get into it. "Just trust me. It's over." "Well, then, you'll get over him and find someone else," I said. "You're not even 30. You have plenty of time." "Do you promise?" she asked so quickly that I couldn't help questioning whether she truly loved Will or she just wanted to get married. Maybe any cute boy in Seersucker would do. I obviously couldn't assure her fate any more than I had Daniel's, but I still told her yes, it's all going to be okay. After all, I thought, the universe owed us both a little mercy. A week later, I flew back to Atlanta at Josie's pleading, filled with the usual angst of going home. Being back always unearthed grief that I was able to mostly bury in the bustle of my everyday life in New York, where there was no association to my brother. I took a deep breath and braced myself as I rode the escalator up to Delta baggage. To my surprise, there stood Nolan. He still emailed me every 6 months or so, just to check in and say hello. But incredibly, this was the first time I had laid eyes on him since that night we stood in Daniel's bedroom together. "Hey," he mouthed, waving at me. I had heard from Josie, who occasionally saw him out at bars, that he was better looking than ever. But I still wasn't prepared for how gorgeous he was, standing there in jeans, a t-shirt, and an Old Miss baseball cap. "What are you doing here?" I could feel myself beaming. "My dad was supposed to pick me up." "Yeah, I know. I played golf with him today. I told him I'd get you." He mussed my hair as if I were 12, although he hadn't actually mussed my hair at any age. "You look great, Mare. Wow." "So do you. I've missed you," I said. "I've missed you too," he said, grinning and carrying my bag to his car. As he drove me home, we quickly caught up. He told me he was still working in his family business, his father grooming him to eventually take over. I told him about my law firm and some of its juicier politics. We talked about our parents, how sad it was that mine had divorced, but that his really needed to do the same. We gossiped about people we knew in common. Many had left Atlanta for college, but most had returned to settle down and start families. "Why aren't you married yet?" I asked playfully. "Commitment phobe?" "Nah, just haven't found the right girl," he said. "What about you? Are you seeing anyone?"
"Not at the moment," I said. "I work too much."
Our only moment of silence came as we passed Grady Hospital. Neither of us said Daniel's name out loud, though it hung in the air anyway. When we got to the intersection at West Paces Ferry, he pointed to the OK Cafe.
"Remember the night we went there?"
he asked, as if we had shared countless dinners alone together.
"Of course," I said. "Can you believe it's been almost 7 years?"
he asked, lowering his voice, staring intently at the road.
"No, I really can't," I said, feeling a stab of pain in my chest. "He's missed so many things."
"I know. A lot has changed. You've changed."
"I can't believe I haven't seen you on any of your trips home," he said, as he slowed for a yellow light he could have easily made. I had the feeling he was stalling, prolonging our time together.
"I don't come home that often," I said, thinking of all the times I'd found an excuse to stay at school or work. He looked at me sideways, his expression suddenly changing from mournful to playful.
"Little drama student turned big city hotshot lawyer."
"Nothing hotshot about my job," I said, which was the truth.
"Those heels you're wearing would say otherwise," Nolan said, glancing down at my shoes. "They're nice.
Nice legs, too."
"Thanks," I said, smiling out my window.
"You know, I'd heard that you'd blossomed."
"Who told you that?" I said, basking in the compliment.
"Just the word around town," he said, shaking his head. "Smart, successful, and beautiful."
I nearly pointed out that he was confusing vigilant grooming, compulsive exercising, and general Manhattan polish with true beauty, but decided not to correct him. A few minutes later, he was pulling up to my childhood home, where my mother still lived. Josie's car was in the driveway, and I anticipated a long night of counseling her through the will crisis.
"Hey, Meredith,"
he said as I was getting out of the car. I looked back at him, feeling an ancient twinge of attraction and residual adolescent hero worship.
"Yeah, Nolan?"
"I know you're here to visit your family, but do you think I could take you out while you're home?" You mean, like, to the OK Cafe?
I asked with a trace of coyness. No. Like on a real date.
He cracked his knuckles and shifted in his seat to get a better look at me.
Assuming you think Daniel would be all right with it. He had a pretty strict don't date my sister rule back in the day.
I stared into his eyes, my stomach fluttering a little.
Yeah, I know he did. But that was really more about Josie, I said with a smile, thinking that she was the one Daniel's friends wanted to ask out. And besides, I think he'd make an exception for us. I was sealing our fate, although I didn't yet know it. When we tell our story, we always start there, on that night, with the surprise of seeing him at the airport, and that innocent lift home. Nolan always brings up my heels, and I laugh, and say it was a good thing I'd forgotten to put a pair of flats in my carry-on. We talk about how nice it was to see each other, how we picked up exactly where we'd left off years before. At this point, we fast-forward past our first date, how we went to dinner at the lobster bar, caught a buzz, then returned to his condo where we drank more wine, then got into his unmade bed and had sex. If we were to share that part of the story, I'm sure we'd say that it had been a long time coming, that it felt preordained. But in reality, it just sort of shockingly and quickly happened. It wasn't like me to have a one-night stand. And in the intimate aftermath, my head on Nolan's chest, I told him as much. Well, he said, stroking my hair. You can't really have a one-night stand with someone you've known your whole life. And besides, who said it was only going to be one time? I laughed, then confessed my ancient crush, the way I'd felt that night in my brother's room. He pretended to be surprised, then told me he'd felt something too. I rolled over, pushed up on my elbows, and looked into his eyes. Did you really? I wasn't sure why it mattered to me at this point, but for some reason it did. He nodded. Yeah, I felt really close to you that whole night. Because of Daniel? Or something else? He looked thoughtful and then said, Yes, because of Daniel, but not only that. After all, I'm not in bed with Josie now, am I? No, I said, smiling at him. You're most certainly not. I resisted asking him if he had ever been attracted to her, because I guessed that the answer was probably yes. Are you going to tell her about this? He asked, sounding tentative. I told him no, that I wanted it to be our secret. Okay, he said earnestly. Whatever you want. On Sunday night, I returned to New York, wondering when I'd see Nolan again, guessing it would be another half dozen years. But he had other plans for us, showing up at my Upper East Side doorstep only 5 days later, holding a dozen red roses. Any points that I would have docked for the cliché, he more than made up with his usual style and panache. Told you it wouldn't be a one-night stand, he announced. I laughed and said, How'd you know I'd be free? I took a chance, he said. Are you? I shook my head and told him I had a blind date. He's blind? Nolan said. I laughed again, and he told me to blow the guy off. And so I did. Then played tour guide to Nolan that whole weekend. I couldn't believe it was happening, but I kept telling myself that it wasn't. Not really. We weren't embarking on a relationship. We were just having a fling, living in the moment, motivated by sentimentality. Yet we kept living in the moment, visiting each other every couple of weeks while keeping our secret from my family. I didn't want to get my mother's hopes up the way Josie had with Will. Deep down, I think I didn't want to get my hopes up either, and somehow delude myself into thinking that we could ever be a real couple. I wasn't even sure that was what I wanted. Even after Nolan told me he loved me that Christmas, and I said it back, and we went public with our long-distance relationship, I kept my expectations in check, silently reminding myself that we loved each other but weren't in love. Nor were we long-term compatible. On paper, I was probably too cerebral for him, and he was too good-looking for me. I was an introvert. He was an extrovert. I loved the arts. He loved sports. I wanted to stay in New York. He couldn't leave his family's business in Atlanta. Our breakup was inevitable. A question of when, not if. Then, one muggy Saturday in July, about 9 months after our first date, Nolan and I went for a long walk through Chastain Park, ending up on Wilkins Field, where he and my brother had played baseball for so many years. We strolled along the bases and then sat in the empty dugout, looking through the chain-link fence, out over the beautifully groomed diamond. It was just before dusk, the sun casting a golden light over the mound where Nolan had pitched and Daniel had occasionally relieved. "This was Danny's favorite place in the world," Nolan said, seeming to be talking to himself more than to me. "Yeah, I know," I said, wishing I had spent less time playing with Josie in the bleachers or making trips to the concession stand, and more time watching my brother play. In our reflective silence, Nolan took my hand and gave me a soulful glance. I suddenly had the feeling he was going to end our relationship, something that I'd been contemplating lately, or at least anticipating. It had been a good run and a lot of fun, but something just felt missing. I was still sad, though, hating endings of any kind. Bracing myself, I mumbled, "Go on, just get it over with." At least that is Nolan's recollection and where we pick up with our official tale. He looked at me, confused. "Aren't you about to break up with me?" I said. Nolan laughed and shook his head and said, "No, Meredith, I am not going to break up with you." Then he got down on one knee in that dusty dugout and asked the question I had never imagined hearing from him, or anyone for that matter. "Will you marry me?" For a second, I thought he was kidding, until he produced a beautiful, sparkling princess-cut diamond ring. I stared at it, then at him, feeling stunned and a little scared. In my heart, the answer was no, or at the very most, maybe. But I said nothing, just shook my head, bit my lip, and blinked back tears. "Say something," Nolan said with a nervous laugh. "I can't." I think I meant to say that I couldn't marry him, but it sounded like I was telling him that I couldn't speak. So he just kept talking, giving me a rambling, heartfelt speech. First he told me how much he loved me, that he'd never known a girl like me. Then he went on to tell me how he'd asked my parents for permission, and both of them had wept, my mother calling him her surrogate son. He talked about all the memories we had shared over so many years. He said that he and I, we, were the only possible silver lining to Daniel's otherwise useless death. He said he could picture my brother up there rooting for him, just as he had so many times from this field, this very bench. And with that final comment about my brother, my no or maybe turned to yes. And for better or worse, my uncertain future became something I'd always imagined for my sister. Our engagement was short, both because I didn't want a big wedding and because I worried that if it were long, one of us might call the other's bluff, point out that for as long as we had known each other, we didn't know each other well enough to get married. After all, we'd been together less than a year, all of it long distance, our time together feeling more like a vacation than normal everyday life. Despite the horrible thing we had been through so long ago, our relationship itself had never been tested. We'd never even had a major argument. Yet not once did I express any of these reservations to Nolan, which I think said a lot, in and of itself. The only time I discussed my fears at all was with Josie, the weekend she and my mom flew to New York to help me find a wedding dress. "I really don't know if I should have said yes," I blurted out, standing in my underwear, staring at my ring in a posh dressing room at Mika Inatomi as the sales girl left to retrieve another dress. It was the one appointment my mom missed, as she was back at my apartment with another migraine. "To Nolan?" my sister said, looking appalled. I nodded. "You're kidding, right?" "No," I said softly. I think I'm having second thoughts.
She furrowed her brow, then reassured me that it was just a little case of cold feet.
I think it might be more than that, I told her.
Come on, Mare, she said, launching into a pep talk that I could tell she believed completely. You're marrying Nolan Brady. He's gorgeous. He's loaded. He's funny. And he's a really nice guy.
I know, I said, feeling guilty and ungrateful.
I mean, look at that rock.
She took my left hand in her right and shook it.
I know, I said, gazing back down at my ring. But it's not really me. Neither are these gowns. So what? Those things don't matter. You're marrying a great guy. Are you seriously finding something to be unhappy about here?
She said in the tone of voice I often took with her.
I sighed and tried to explain. It's just, sometimes I feel like we rushed into this. That the ring was a bit of an impulse purchase. That I might be an impulse purchase.
Come on, Mare, you act like you just met at a bar. You've known each other forever, Josie said.
For your whole life.
I know, but we haven't been together for very long at all, and I don't want him to regret it, I said.
That's ridiculous, Josie said. He adores you. He worships you.
Maybe, I said, because I did get the feeling that Nolan admired a lot of things about me. He was proud of my career, and how smart I was. Special was the word he always used. He made me feel special. I took a deep breath and said, "But is he in love with me, or the idea of me?"
"The idea of you," Josie said. "You're not Julia Roberts. What do you mean, the idea of you?"
"I don't know," I said, frustrated that I couldn't describe the way I was feeling to my own sister, though I knew it had something to do with Daniel and the reasons I had said yes.
"Do you love him?"
she asked. I told her yes, because I did, wishing I could put my finger on the thing that felt missing. I thought of Louis, not for the first time in recent months. I was way over him, but longed for the intense way I'd once felt. But then I asked myself whether that kind of passion was necessarily a good thing, or a feeling that would always inevitably fade. I was so confused.
"Look, Meredith," Josie said gently, "you're looking for something that doesn't exist. And if you break up with Nolan, you'll regret it forever. Like I'm regretting Will."
Her voice shook a little, then trailed off. She still hadn't told me all the details of their breakup, and clearly was never going to. But I knew that Will had already moved on with another serious relationship. I nodded, having always been motivated by fear of regret, and agreed that she was probably right.
"Thanks, Josie," I whispered.
"Of course," she smiled, putting her arm around me, then pulling me into a full-on hug.
"Now come on, let's do this."
I hugged her back, feeling a tiny bit better, just as our sales girl bustled in with a new gown, this one more embellished than the others, lacy with extensive beadwork along the bodice.
"Oh, I love it," Josie said, turning to me. "What do you think, Mare?"
"Too fancy," I said, shaking my head.
"Just try it," she insisted.
I sighed, letting the two of them help me into it, then zip me up and arrange the train at my feet.
"Wow,"
Josie said, as she spun me toward the mirror. I looked at my reflection and couldn't resist a small smile.
"See," she said, "I told you."
"It is pretty good, isn't it?" I asked my sister.
"It's perfect. And so is the ring, and so is Nolan. And so is your life, you bitch."
"You're the bitch," I said, smiling back and deciding once and for all that I was going to go through with it. And that was that. In the next few months, everything happened quickly. I resigned from my job, landed a new law firm in Atlanta, and bought my childhood home on Delwood from my mother. It was the perfect solution, as she felt that the house was too big for her to live in alone, but desperately wanted to keep it in our family. Then, one beautiful, bright autumn afternoon, I stood in the front of the church where Daniel's coffin had rested and exchanged vows with his best friend.
Chapter 7. Josie. The morning after my last date ever, Pete calls while I'm still asleep, leaving me a rambling voicemail.
So, I've given it a lot of thought.
He launches in without saying hello.
Well, as much thought as you can give something in less than 12 hours, of which 7 were spent sleeping. So anyway, contrary to your opinion, I think chemistry can develop over time. In fact, I can think of several significant examples in film and literature in which one or both parties had absolutely no romantic interest in the other at the outset of their interaction, only to find that it blossomed, intensely, later.
I smile as I listen, suddenly genuinely interested, not necessarily in Pete himself, but in where he's going with this. So I say we give it another try, just to be sure. In fact, if you're free tonight, I'm going to a rooftop party. I'd love for you to join me, and you're welcome to bring a friend, so she can judge me, perhaps offer a second opinion. So give me a buzz and let me know what you think. I listen to the message one more time, then delete it, shaking my head at the predictability of it all. It is a page right out of one of those dating handbooks, my sudden indifference and independence, neither of which can really be faked, had made me more attractive to the opposite sex. I call Pete back immediately, something the old strategic me never would have done, and say, "So, what are your examples from film and literature?"
"Who's this?"
He deadpans over loud music. "It's Josie," I say, mimicking his dry tone. "Your blind date from last night?"
"Oh, yes. Hi there, Josie," he says, turning off his music.
"So, what are your examples?" I say again. "And do you have any real-life examples or just fictional ones?"
"I'll tell you in person, tonight."
"So you really are asking me out 2 nights in a row?"
"Yes," he says, "I really am."
You know that's like 101 of what not to do if you like someone?
"Who said I liked you?"
"Touché," I say, grinning into the phone.
"So what do you think about the party? It should be fun. I hear this chick throws Gatsby-esque parties, over the top."
The description tempts me for a second, but I reply with a quip. "How did Brio Boy score an invite to a party like that?"
"She tore her ACL ballroom dancing. I worked on her knee."
He confesses,
"She told me I was welcome to bring friends."
"She probably meant guy friends," I say. "I bet she likes you."
"Nah, it's not like that," he says.
"So are you in?" I hesitate, but am determined not to succumb to the slippery slope. "I don't think so," I say, holding firm.
"That's it? You don't think so? You're not even going to make something up? Like tell me you already have plans or something?"
I laugh and say I actually do already have plans.
"To do what?"
he says, breaking another cardinal rule. "Don't ask nosy questions during your first phone conversation." "I'm staying in tonight. I'm going to research sperm banks," I say. He laughs, but when I don't respond, he says,
"You're not kidding about that, are you?"
"Nope," I say, trying not to think about the potential good genes that could be awaiting me on that roof tonight. It's the false promise that has always motivated me, kept me going out weekend after weekend. There is always an agenda. The point is always to meet someone, even if disguised in the form of a girl's night out. Even if you're one of those people who pretends to actually enjoy going to the movies or eating at a bar alone. Even if you try to convince yourself that you just want to enjoy a nice end-of-the-summer rooftop party.
"Well, at least that's a lofty pursuit," he says. "Will you let me know how it goes?"
"Are you really interested?"
"Yes," Pete says,
moderately. I hang up, wondering if he's talking about me or my project. I have a hunch that it is both, and have to admit that the feeling is mutual. But I remind myself that moderate interest is no longer my thing. As promised, I dedicate the rest of the day to donor research, taking detailed notes about fertility doctors and sperm banks in Atlanta on a lined yellow tablet I previously used to jot down interesting profiles, including Pete's, from Match.com. As I surf and read and pop into various chat rooms, I feel increasingly excited and empowered, liberated to let the whole marriage dream die. All I need is some good sperm and a doctor to put it in me. It isn't going to be easy or inexpensive, but it is much more straightforward than finding the one, and more important, blissfully within my control. Every few hours, I go find Gabe somewhere in the house or yard and share nuggets of my newly acquired expertise. He listens intently, the way he always does, but I have the feeling he's mostly humoring me. His interest is finally piqued when I stumble upon a website dedicated to sharing the testimonies, both positive and negative, of parties involved in third-party reproduction, from the egg and sperm donors to the donor-conceived children to the surrogate mothers to the actual parents. If you were the product of a sperm or egg donor, do you think that something would feel missing in your life? I ask him after reading aloud a particularly troubling account of a donor-conceived teenage girl who knew virtually nothing about her biological father and is now grappling with her identity, concluding with, "I will never forgive my mother for her selfish decision, one that has left a permanent hole in my heart and soul."
"Sounds like a typical melodramatic teenager to me," Gabe says, glancing over his shoulder.
A homebody, he has stayed in tonight to watch broadcast news, one of his favorite movies, and hits pause as he finishes his reply.
"If she knew her old man, she'd just find something else to hate her mom for."
"Maybe," I say. "So you don't think you'd feel bitter?"
"If I didn't know my biological father?"
Gabe asks with a wry look because he actually doesn't know his biological father, who died of prostate cancer just after Gabe's birth. The only father he's ever known is his stepdad, the soft-spoken, kindly professor his mother married when Gabe was 7. For a couple of years, Gabe called him Stan, but at some point started to call him Dad. "But even though you didn't know your real father," I say, trying to differentiate the scenarios, "you at least knew who he was. He was never a complete mystery."
"But a sperm donor doesn't have to be a complete mystery either," he says. "You said yourself earlier today that there are all sorts of different arrangements."
"True," I say, thinking of the story I read about the girl who connected with her donor dad and biological half-siblings via Facebook. "But that presents another whole set of issues." Gabe shrugs, still staring at the frozen screen, right in the middle of the scene where Albert Brooks sweats profusely.
"Everyone has issues, and at the end of the day, you are who you are."
I blink and say, "What does that mean, you are who you are?" He sighs.
"Let's say I found out that I actually came from donated sperm rather than the man I know from old photos and a few memories. Or let's say that my mom had an affair with the milkman and I just found out. Then I'd still be exactly who I am today."
I stare at him blankly.
"I mean, it's just a donated cell," he says. "At the end of the day, it's no different than a donated heart or cornea or kidney."
"It's totally different," I say, even though I want to believe in what he's saying. "A cornea is not the same as half your DNA."
"Granted," he says, "but it also doesn't change who you really are. Whether I came from my biological father, donated sperm, I was still raised by my mom and Stan, my dad."
I take a deep breath and say, "But what if I had a baby with donated sperm and didn't ever get married? What if I never gave my child a father of any kind?"
"Well, that's a different issue altogether. That's about the people in your life rather than your identity. And that scenario could happen anyway. People die. They leave. Lots of people grow up without a mother or father. So if you didn't ever marry, then your child would just have you." He shrugs. "So what?"
"So what?" I say. "Isn't that sad?"
"Sadder than never being born at all?"
I nod as he offers his final summation.
"People just need to be who they are."
I stare at him, digesting his Gabe-like quote, as he hits play on his movie, and I move on to an uplifting testimony from a grandmother of a donor-conceived baby being raised by her lesbian daughter and partner. I reassure myself that the positive, inspiring stories with hunky-dory endings seem to far outweigh the tales of woe, especially when everyone involved is honest from the beginning. At the end of the day, it isn't so unlike traditional families, really. All of us vulnerable to tragedy and estrangement, lies, and secrets. Gabe, I say.
Uh-huh.
He asks, this time not pausing the movie. Do you think I'm crazy for considering this?
Are you really considering it? Or is this just like your Buddhist meditation kick?
He asks, still staring at the screen. I'm more than considering this, I say, feeling my first wave of genuine fear, which, in a sense, confirms my answer. Do you think I'm crazy?
Yep,
Gabe says with a smirk.
But no crazier than usual. And like I said, people just need to be who they are.
That night, before I go to bed, I call Meredith, really wanting to talk to my sister about everything. I can tell right away she's in a bad mood, which is pretty consistent these days. What's wrong? I ask her.
Nothing.
You sound pissed off.
I'm not.
All right, I say. So what'd you do today?
3 loads of laundry, grocery shopping. Oh, and I picked up Nolan's shirts at the dry cleaners,
she says, perfecting her martyr routine.
That's it? Let's see. I also took Harper to Buckles.
Did she get some cute shoes? I ask.
No, she pitched an epic fit over a pair of purple glitter sandals, and we had to leave.
I laugh, and she adds gratuitous commentary.
Mom says there's no justice in the world since I never pulled stunts like that. That was your department.
Weary of the good girl, bad girl shtick, I sigh, but decide to use it as an opening. So, I guess that means I'll have the perfect child, I chirp. She doesn't react to this, nor does she even bother to ask what I did today, which is just common fucking courtesy. Instead, she informs me that she ran into our old friend Shauna at the shoe store. She was buying her son his first pair of sneakers, little blue kids.
How'd she look?
I ask.
Very good,
she says. Did she lose her baby weight?
Yes, she looked thinner than I've ever seen her.
Too thin?
No, not too thin.
Did she seem happy? I ask.
As happy as you can be with a toddler, Meredith replies.
Did she ask about me? I say against my better judgment. Meredith always accuses me of making things all about myself.
No, but she did tell me y'all haven't talked in months.
I detect a note of satisfaction in her voice, and feel another wave of irritation, along with a stab of sibling rivalry at the mention of Shauna, our only shared friend growing up.
I wouldn't say months, but it's been a while. She wants to get drinks.
The three of us? I ask.
She mentioned me and Nolan, a double date thing, Meredith says, but I'm sure she'd love to hear from you, too.
Right, I say, thinking this is what I get for wanting to confide in my sister. Okay, Mare, I'll let you go.
If you want to go, say you want to go. Don't tell me you'll let me go.
She says, now just being a straight-up bitch. Okay, then, I say, careful to keep my voice light. I want to go. I hang up, pissed off at Meredith and pissed off at Shauna for giving Meredith that kind of ammunition, even unwittingly. She, of all people, knows our complicated history. The three of us going back to 1989, when the Ebersoles moved in across the street from us. Shauna was between us in age, but she was precocious and had skipped a grade. Her mother, a Coke executive, had transferred the family from Hong Kong, enrolling Shauna at the Atlanta International School so that she could continue to use her Chinese. It was one of the many things that fascinated Meredith and me, along with her wealth of stories and breadth of travel, in stark contrast to the mainstay destinations of most Buckhead families, which included, give or take, Lake Burton, Sea Island, and Kiowa. The three of us went on long bike rides, built forts along the creek behind Shauna's house, and played capture the flag with the other neighborhood kids. One summer, we planted a vegetable garden, then went door to door peddling basil and tomatoes from Daniel's old red wagon. I remember Shauna coming up with most of the ideas, doing most of the talking, and generally entertaining Meredith and me. Looking back, I think Mare would agree that it was the only truly harmonious era of our sisterhood. In middle school, Shauna morphed from our playmate into our fearless, experimental pioneer. The first adult penis Meredith and I ever saw was compliments of Shauna, straight from her parents' very own porn magazine collection, which they casually stowed in their nightstand along with a tube of KY jelly, the purpose of which Shauna clinically described. I still remember how my sister and I vacillated between horror and fascination at the sight of that large slab of bratwurst-like flesh slung over the muscular thigh of a burly Nordic man named Big John. We gagged and covered our eyes, then peeked, then gawked, then analyzed, parsing out the anatomy, where his hairless scrotum attached to the long shaft, ending with that one-eyed pink head. Shortly after that, Shauna taught us about masturbation, the myriad ways she pleasured herself, even demonstrating the swirling of her two fingers through the silk fabric of her pajama bottoms. There was no such thing as a taboo topic with Shauna, and she was just as likely to research a provocative issue on her own as to ask her parents directly. What was the difference between gay and transgender? How could someone be against abortion except in cases of incest or rape if killing a baby was wrong? Wasn't it wrong no matter what the circumstances? And on and on. In those years forming the bridge from childhood to adolescence, Shauna was not only our friend and confidant, but also the source of many a secret that Meredith and I guarded together. Our parents, both conservative Presbyterian Republicans, liked the Ebersoles well enough, but they called Shauna out there and referred to her parents as permissive and liberal. I can vividly remember Dad's face turning bright red when she told us at dinner one night that creationism was an ignorant myth perpetuated in red states, and how he had stammered a retort that the Bible was most certainly not a myth. Only Daniel could calm him down, shifting the conversation to intelligent design. How it was possible to reconcile Christianity with Darwinism and evolution. It also helped that Daniel enjoyed Shauna in much the same way he loved Nolan. Neither was ever dull. In any event, we remained a threesome until the summer before Shauna and I entered the 9th grade, when she convinced her parents to let her transfer to Lovett, where Daniel and I went to school. The writing was on the wall, but Meredith fiercely resisted the inevitable shift in our dynamic. Her feelings were perpetually hurt, which only annoyed Shauna and me, as did her tattling to Mom and Dad that we were blowing her off and leaving her out. I insisted that it wasn't like that at all. Shauna and I simply had more in common. We were in the same grade, the same school, for heaven's sake. Beyond that, we had different interests. Meredith listened to downer folk music. Shauna and I danced to R&B and pop. Meredith didn't speak to boys. Shauna and I had begun to date. Meredith was a goody two-shoes. Shauna and I sneaked cigarettes and beer. "What's the big deal?" I'd say to Mom when she pulled me aside and talked to me about my sister's feelings. She pointed out that Meredith was a bit of a loner and had come to rely on Shauna and me. I retorted that the age gap had become more significant over time and that high schoolers didn't hang out with middle schoolers. Mom argued that Shauna had always been a neighborhood friend. "Not anymore," I said. Over time, Meredith moved past the big betrayal and made her own theater friends at Pace, but I think it always stung. Shauna remained a longtime sore spot between us. Deep down, I knew I was being insensitive, and maybe even a little mean, and looking back, I can see there was definitely a competitive component, too. My sister, like my brother, was a parent pleaser. She wasn't as crazy smart as Daniel, but she got really good grades in honors classes, never got in trouble, and most important, had a genuine passion and talent for acting. Mom and Dad raved about her plays and performances, just like they raved about Daniel's baseball, while I was the classic middle child with no sport or hobby to make me special. It was lame to consider Shauna a feather in my cap, but I took secret satisfaction in beating my sister in this particular tug of war. After graduation, Shauna and I both decided on the University of Georgia. Our freshman year, we were closer than ever, rooming together, then pledging the same sorority. We even started to look alike, wearing the same clothes and sporting the same super long, over-bleached, flat-ironed hair. Some people confused us or asked if we were twins, which I found flattering. Then sophomore year, Shauna started dating Jacob Marsh, asshole extraordinaire. I couldn't stand him and made the mistake of telling her as much, which almost always backfires. It certainly did in our case, the two of us drifting apart until Shauna finally came to her senses and dumped Jacob, his cue to leak a video of Shauna masturbating to Madonna's Justify My Love. It spread within days, not only all over UGA, but across the SEC to Auburn, Alabama, and Ole Miss. Beyond the fact that she was thoroughly humiliated, she was also kicked out of AD Pi under the promiscuity clause. A group of us appealed the decision, arguing it wasn't her fault the video got out. It was supposed to be private. But the ladies at the national office weren't budging, and Shauna had to move out of our house. She ended up transferring to Georgia State, and we drifted apart even more, much to what I perceived as Meredith's odd vindication. I remember when she heard the news, her first reaction wasn't sympathy, but an off-the-cuff announcement that she always knew Shauna was trouble. The next time I saw Shauna was over the following Christmas break, when we ran into each other at a bar in Atlanta. I gave her a hug and told her how much I missed her. She said she missed me too, but things felt strained. It made me sad, the emotion heightened by the encroaching holidays, but a little bit angry too. After all, it wasn't my fault that she had trusted such a jerk. As I watched her hanging out with her new friends, I made the conscious decision to have more fun than they were having. I downed my vodka drink, then ordered another, on my way to a blackout drunken night. The kind with big gaping holes, followed by nothingness. In fact, I'm sure the entire night would have eventually been forgotten altogether, except that it happened to be the very night I lost my brother in a car accident.
Chapter 8. Meredith. About a week later, Josie sends a cryptic group email requesting that my parents, Nolan Harper, and I join her for dinner the following evening. She tells us not to worry, but goes on to say that she has something important to discuss with us. She acknowledges how busy we all are, and that my parents might not be keen on the idea of seeing each other, but then essentially insists that we join her the night she is proposing. The whole thing is classic Josie, calling shots, making demands, creating drama. Mom calls me within 5 minutes of the email appearing in our inboxes. "Do you think it's health-related?" she asks, panic rising in her voice. "Has she had a recent mammogram? Or any doctor's appointments that you know about? She never tells me anything." "Mom, calm down," I say, putting her on speaker, so I can continue to work on the answers to a set of interrogatories due by the end of the day. "She wouldn't include Harper if it were to tell us about a lump in her breast or anything dire like that. Frankly, I don't see her including Dad in that conversation either, at least not initially." I quickly change the subject, as the only person I want to analyze less than Josie is my father. I'm certainly not going to tell my mother that he has a new girlfriend, although I'm sure Josie will bring that up tomorrow night, too. Hell, she probably invited her in a separate email. "When did you talk to her last?" she asks. Last Saturday night," I say. "She called me at some ungodly hour. I was half asleep." "Did she sound upset?" "No, Mom, she just wanted to chat. Apparently, she can't keep track of my please don't call me after 10 rule any more than she can remember not to wear her shoes in my house." "So, do you think Josie might actually have good news?" Mom asks with pathetic hope. "Maybe a raise?" "I doubt it," I say, thinking that it is more likely to be a financial issue than a raise. It certainly wouldn't be the first time that Josie asked to borrow money from one of us. Mom throws out another theory. "Maybe she met someone." "Wouldn't she just tell us that?" I say. "Besides, that doesn't seem possible given her current will obsession." "I know," Mom says. "I asked her about the first week of school, and all she really talked about was that little girl. It's sad." "Sad meaning pathetic?"
Be nice, she says. I sigh, taking her off speaker. I'm trying, Mom, but it's hard. She's so selfish. Everything is about her. This email is a case in point. Meredith, please give your sister a chance, she says. You always assume the worst about her. Maybe she wants to talk about Daniel and our trip to see Sophie. Or... I cut her off, confident that this meeting has nothing whatsoever to do with Daniel. I'll tell you what, I say. Let's see what she wants to discuss. If it's not something completely self-serving, I'll start giving her a chance. The following night, when Nolan Harper and I arrive at my sister's house, she is nowhere to be seen. Instead, my parents and Gabe are sitting awkwardly in the living room, a hodgepodge of Josie's anthropology taste and Gabe's more contemporary leanings. Mom and Dad are both perched on hideous matching zebra print side chairs that Josie bought at a flea market, while Gabe is kicked back on his leather sofa with a bored look on his face. Obviously, I know he and Josie are housemates, but for some reason I didn't expect to see him tonight, and his sullen presence irritates me more than usual. Or perhaps I'm just a little more irritated with Josie for pulling the stunt, including a non-family member, and not even bothering to show up on time. It suddenly crosses my mind that her announcement might actually involve Gabe, that maybe they've begun to date or are starting some crazy business venture. But I really think he has more sense than to try either, even though they clearly have some dysfunctional connection. I say a terse hello, not even trying to hide my annoyance, while Nolan overcompensates with a more boisterous than usual greeting, hugging my mother, then my father, and saying all the right son-in-law things. They both adore him, although it's hard to say how much of that is him and how much is his connection to Daniel. In Dad's case, I really think it's the latter, which makes Nolan a constant source of both comfort and sadness to him. Inevitably, when they get together, the conversation will turn to the past, and they will rehash the same old stories, little league games, and inside jokes. And even if they start out with laughter, Dad always ends up crying while Nolan does the consoling, proving it's way easier for a friend to move on than a parent. "Come here, Harper, sweetie," Dad says, still standing. His arms are outstretched. I glance over my shoulder at Harper, who doesn't move, just continues to pet Revis, Josie's poorly trained rescue dog. "Harper," I say, "Grandpa's talking to you." She looks up with a blank expression, as Nolan propels her forward with an under-the-breath, "Go hug Grandpa." She begrudgingly obeys, backing into my dad's arms. It is visible evidence that the two aren't at all close, which Nolan blames on me, rather than the alcoholic who checked out of our family. Harper makes a quick escape, then heads directly for my mom's lap. "Where's Josie anyway?" I say, pacing in front of the fireplace as I inspect her lineup of photographs. Various snapshots of her with Gabe and other friends, along with one of Harper. There are none of me, Daniel, or our parents. "She's just getting out of the shower," Gabe says, his expression inscrutable. "Harper, honey, go get Aunt Josie," I say, still pacing. As Harper hops off of Mom's lap and scampers down the hall, I make a snide comment about Josie's time being more valuable than anyone else's. Nobody bothers to defend her because they can't. Instead, I sit next to Gabe and ask him point blank if he knows what's up. He gives me a non-committal shrug. I can never tell whether he dislikes me or just has a prickly personality. But I can count on my hand the number of times he has seemed to be in a genuinely good mood in my presence. "She hasn't told you anything?" I ask him. I find that hard to believe. Before he can respond, Harper bursts back into the room, leading Josie by the hand. Her hair is wrapped up in a towel, and she's wearing sweats that could pass for pajamas. "Hey," she says, all easy breezy, "how is everyone?" "Just fabulous," I say as sarcastically as possible, as Nolan sits on the other side of me and squeezes my knee, in an attempt to either reprimand or calm me. Josie stares me down, crosses her arms, and says, "Okay, that was so fake." "Listen, Josie," I say, We're all a little worried about why you called this meeting tonight.
It's not a meeting, it's dinner, she says, tucking a strand of wet hair into her towel as she plops down onto the floor, center stage.
But you said in your formal group email that you had something to tell us, didn't you? I say.
Josie nods.
Well, I say, what is it then?
Geez, settle down, Mare, Josie says, which pretty much always has the opposite effect on anyone who's even the tiniest bit agitated.
Josie, I say, my voice just short of shouting, Nolan and I are worried. Mom's worried. Dad's worried.
I'm not really worried, actually, Dad says. Should I be?
Yes, I snap. You should be, Dad. I want to add, and if you ever thought about anyone other than Daniel, you would be. But I don't want to confuse the main issue.
No, he shouldn't be, Josie says.
There's absolutely nothing to worry about here. It's all good.
I tense up, thinking that it's never all good.
Just tell us you're healthy, Mom says before kissing the top of Harper's head.
Perfectly healthy, Josie says.
I just wanted to have my family over and talk to you about something. Her voice trails off.
Josie, Gabe finally says. He's the only one who can ever really reason with her.
Why don't you just tell them so we can have dinner?
She takes a deep breath, seeming to relish the moment.
Wait, I say, as it occurs to me that her news might not be rated PG. Are you sure this is okay for Harper to hear?
Josie glares at me.
Oh my God, could you have any less confidence in me?
I'm sorry, I say, but I have to put my daughter first.
Look, Meredith, she snaps back. I really don't appreciate the implication that I'd do anything.
Girls, Mom pleads. Please, please don't fight. This is hard enough.
Actually, Mom, there's nothing hard about tonight whatsoever, Josie says.
This is a celebration.
I have wonderful news.
I shake my head, feeling certain that I won't agree, as she stands, looks purposefully around the room, and says in a loud, clear voice,
What I brought you here to tell you is that I'm going to have a baby.
She takes a deep breath, then smiles, looking triumphant. At least 5 seconds of stunned silence pass before Harper begins to clap and cheer, mimicking the reaction to our good friend's pregnancy news last month, clearly unable to distinguish the vast difference between the two scenarios.
A girl baby?
She asks, her eyes bright.
Oh, that I don't know yet, sweetie, Josie says,
beaming as I grind my teeth into my tongue, determined not to be the first adult to speak, especially since the only words coming to mind are, What the fuck?
Hey, Joe, Gabe says under his breath, you might want to clarify here.
She gives him a blank look as it occurs to me, once again, that he might have a role in all this.
Your announcement, it's a bit misleading, he says.
When she continues to look befuddled, he gives her his best don't be such a dipshit look, then clues the rest of us in.
She's not currently pregnant, he says. It's just her plan to become pregnant.
I watch Mom exhale with visible relief.
Oh, yeah, right, Josie says with a dismissive wave of her hand. When I say I'm going to have a baby, I don't mean that I'm pregnant now. I mean that I plan to get pregnant as soon as possible.
And how do you plan on accomplishing that, exactly? I ask her.
I'm going to a sperm bank, she says. That's how.
I glance at Nolan and take twisted pleasure in the fact that he finally looks annoyed.
Josie,
he says, gesturing toward Harper.
Oh, come on, she doesn't know what a sperm bank is, Josie says under her breath,
which, of course, is Harper's cue to ask what a sperm bank is.
Harper, honey, why don't you get Revis a bone, Mom says.
Harper happily takes this suggestion, but before she's even out of the room, Josie says,
I don't think there's anything so secretive about...
I'm going to want Harper to know where her cousin comes from.
Fine, Nolan says calmly but firmly. When she's old enough to understand it.
but we'd really like to avoid a discussion about the birds and the bees at age 4.
That was not my intent, Josie says, then launches into one of her know-it-all explanations about child development.
I cut her off.
Well, when you have your test tube baby, you can make those